This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Around the world, identity politics are slackening the ties that bind political communities, and nationalist forces are reasserting the importance of such bonds. The crucial mechanism underlying those bonds is the institution of citizenship. Going back at least to Aristotle, citizenship, the experience of, as he described it, of ruling and being ruled, has been regarded in Western political thought as a bedrock institution. Yet it has come to be seen in recent years as a source of inequality and exclusion as much as a foundation of political equality. So what's happening to citizenship? My name is John Torpy, and I'm director of the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Welcome to International Horizons, a podcast of the Ralph Bunche Institute that brings some scholarly and diplomatic expertise to bear on our understanding of a wide range of international issues. We're fortunate to have with us today David Jacobson, who is professor of sociology at the University of South Florida in Tampa. He's a widely influential scholar of citizenship. His most recent book with Manlio Cinali of the University of Milan is called Citizenship, the Third Revolution, and was published by Oxford University Press in September of last year. His previous book was called Of Virgins and Martyrs, Woman's Status in Global Conflict, published by Johns Hopkins University Press in 2014. Professor Jacobson is also the author of, among other works, Rights Across Borders, Immigration and the Decline of Citizenship, also by Johns Hopkins. He's also authored a book called Place and Belonging in America. And that may seem more salient as an issue to somebody who was born in South Africa, as you'll no doubt hear in a moment. And he received his training at the Hebrew University in Israel, at the London University of School of Economics. He got his master's and PhD from Princeton University. He's currently working on an interdisciplinary study with colleagues at the University of Oslo and NTNU, a study of Viking violence, and with collaborators at the University of South Florida, on a project on the trajectories of ESG and its relationship to human rights. Thanks for joining us today, David Jacobson.
Thank you, John. Great pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. So your first book, which is really what led us to meeting a long time ago, your first book, Rights Across Borders, Immigration and the Decline of Citizenship, made an influential argument about what was called post-nationalism and the, quote, decline of citizenship, unquote, in recent years. And so for those who may not be familiar with these debates, perhaps you could begin by telling us what you think has been going on in the study and in the reality of citizenship during your career of now more than 30 years.
Well, that book came out in 1996, and the 1990s, as we remember, was a period of great optimism, sadly distant now, and there was this talk of the end of history and the triumph of liberal democracy. And it was also shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War, and there was a heady optimism about the role of human rights, which heavily, as I'll come to in a moment, impacted this notion of post-national citizenship. And this role of human rights at this period was understood both domestically and in principles justifying Western intervention in, for example, the former Yugoslavia. It's also the decade when globalization, of course, is beginning to really take a hold, both in its economic terms and in cultural terms, and making its mark. And it's in that context that shifts in citizenship are evident and begins to start shaping the debate on citizenship, the scholarly debate. But we see institutional and legal changes before that. And in fact, it's before the 1990s that we see an inflection point when it comes to international human rights law, the foundations of which serve as the foundations of post-national citizenship argument. And that in inflection point, we can mark pretty closely and empirically from the 1970s. And it's kind of interesting, there's this long debate, of course, and when we look at international law and particularly international human rights law, there's the cynical argument that it's kind of an organized hypocrisy of states and nod and wink without taking it seriously. And there are others who look at this as having independent normative effect. What's interesting with human rights is I think something more subtle was going on. It begins to emerge many treaties from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights straight after the war to the many other treaties on migrants, on women, on children, a variety of them, myriad treaties, begin to build up in this immediate post-war period. But where I think the organized hypocrisy argument really applies, because they're not taken very seriously in any practical sense. But the infrastructure, the foundations, the regime of human rights is in fact being put in place, and for various reasons in democracies from the 1970s. And an important factor is the growth of migrant populations in Western democracies. Courts begin to turn to these human rights instruments. So it's a more subtle relationship than pure organized hypocrisy, as it's often called, straightforward normative effect. But the longer term effect here is that citizenship begins to start responding. Citizenship law and practices within the national context begin responding to this growing importance of the human rights regime, if I can put it that way, and the asylum, the universal right to claim asylum, not necessarily get it, but to claim it, is an example of this, and has monumental effect that we're seeing in dramatic ways today. But the longer term effect is dramatic also in terms of post-national citizenship, contributed to dual citizenship, no longer the sense that we could only have one national loyalty, the growing rights of non-citizens residents, the partial decoupling of nationality from the state. But the state remains critical, and a lot of critics of the post-national argument forget this aspect of it. They think it's some kind of stateless global political movement, but in fact, in practice, the state remains critical, as it's through the state human rights may be advanced. And so this post-national turn had the promise of helping us among democracies to pivot to a more civic political system, less driven by the primordialist elements of nation states and of identity politics. But the key, what many scholars of human rights, activists of human rights, didn't pay enough attention to, if any, was some key vulnerabilities that have meant this post-national turn has had significant vulnerabilities. It's an unfinished revolution. And what drives these vulnerabilities is that human rights have been themselves driven primarily judicially. There's been a kind of judicialization of politics through the courts, through legal systems in making these claims, as opposed to going through what people conventionally conceive of as the democratic process. And so what we've witnessed is a kind of partial shift from the politics of consent to the politics of rights. And it's important to understand this shift because it really is at the basis of some underlying basis of some severe divisions we're seeing in our democracies. And the growing role of judicial and administrative officials making decisions for the public, viewed as outside of democratic accountability, has given sustenance to the sense of a democratic deficit and has given the ballast to populist movements that frequently threaten civic politics. And I want to touch on, and that hasn't been addressed sufficiently in terms of thinking how we move human rights forward. And I want to address, you brought up, John, this notion of the decline of the citizenship in the sense of citizenship as traditionally understood. And there are a number of factors driving this. One, you mentioned the growing inequalities, but also we see other developments. There's this widely observed, and I'm quoting here, the legal scholar Peter Spiro, who talked of the mismatch between borders and the map and the boundaries of the human community, end quote. And what binds citizens together within the borders of nation states has become less clear due to, you know, among other things, extensive transnational ties, dual citizenships and the like. What constitutes an authentic claim on the nation of an individual on the nation state is becoming less clear. But most importantly, the bases of civic solidarity, whether within nation states, across borders, but also cross-sectional, as you know, not just ethnic, say, is in question now. So I'll just end with one point that there's some misunderstandings of the post-national argument. One I mentioned, the idea it was replacing the states. Nothing of that sort was claimed or ever happened. But also sometimes a conflation of human rights developments with multiculturalism. They're actually distinct, and different models can fit within human rights, which may not be multicultural. And the relationship with multiculturalism is much more ambiguous. And it's fascinating if one goes through court cases across various democracies, not only Western, if you look in Japan and others, there's been a distinct tension between multiculturalism and human rights norms, particularly when it's come to women and women's status. And so issues of female genital mutilation, child brides, honor killings, forced marriage have invariably been shot down, almost invariably been shot down in courts across the democratic world as antithetical to human rights norms. And courts in democracies have been consistently clear in their judgments in this regard.
Well, that's a fascinating tableau. And I guess what strikes me about it is the fact that it's very much focused on, you know, recent developments, or it was focused then on recent developments when the book came out in 1996, I guess. But now you've written another book called Citizenship, the Third Revolution. And of course, first of all, you have to explain to us what the first two revolutions were. But in any case, you know, what strikes me about the book is compared to the previous book is how much of a long durée kind of approach this is, and how you're really taking a very long view of citizenship in order, I guess, to rejuvenate the idea or the concept or the institution now. But so maybe you could tell us about, you know, what's the argument of the book, what are the three revolutions we should be thinking about, etc.
Well, there's a paradox at the foundation of this book. And as you said, it's on a very large canvas. We go back some 4,500 years to 2,500 BCE. And the paradox is that if we look at human history, at least as Homo sapiens, of all 300,000 years of it, kinship and blood ties have been almost the dominant basis for organizing human association. So questions of rule, questions of who belongs in a community were determined overwhelmingly by birth. And from hunter-gatherers to tribes, answers to the boundaries of community and of rule came naturally, in a literal sense, presumed and unquestioned. People forget, you know, up to at least 11,000 years ago, the biggest communities out walking across this planet of ours were maybe a few dozen people. By 4,500 years ago, we are seeing enormous communities, in the ancient Near East, possibly elsewhere, where we don't have a historical record sufficiently to tell us, but certainly in the ancient Near East, in places like Assyria, in Babylonia, and the like. And the paradox is that when we see these shift to large communities, something's beginning to shift in terms of the idea of kinship as the sole basis of organizing humanity, organizing community. And it's within the ancient Near East, well before the Greeks and Romans, where we usually begin in the classical period, 500 BCE, that these, what we can recognize as issues of citizenship, begin to emerge in the records. These civilizations extend in the ancient Near East over thousands of years, and there were scores of them. And we're familiar, the more familiar ones like Assyria. There's records of them asking questions very similar to ours about, the status of what we'd call non-resident aliens, who belongs. Importantly, they begin to use territoriality as ways of defining a community, because pure kinship in the strictest sense no longer works when you're dealing with the scale of societies. But they still use the language of kinship. They talk of language such as, to the Middle East to this very day, if people define themselves of in this patrilineal way, I'm the son of so-and-so, and down it goes in a patrilineal society, patriarchal society. The language would shift to, I'm the son of this land. And so the kinship element thread doesn't disappear. And that's important to understand this paradox. By the way, we see that shift from, I'm the son of this father, to I'm the son of this land in classical India, about 500 BCE. And there's no record of them being influenced what happened in the ancient Near East previously. But what's key, the paradox is, even though we begin to see this emergence of the idea of, or the inklings of what we can call citizenship, if hitherto societies, kinship-based societies, proffered these unchanging fixed attributes of family, tribe, and status based on sex and age, a seed was being planted for a more labile, flexible notion of individual roles. And citizenship had the seed of a promise of a new way of being in the world, and could raise this question of who belongs and who rules could be answered in principle in very different ways now, if it was not tied to blood, but based on principles. The paradox is kinship, either in a literal sense or in a metaphorical sense, never goes away. And it haunts the civic project to this day. Even in the Enlightenment, which does generate, enormously important changes for republicanism and such like, they still rely on notions of race begin to emerge. The principles that scholars talk about so much of ius sanguinis, ius soli, is about birth on the land, birth on the soil, birth to this particular people or not, has these resonances of kinship. So it's not to say great progress is not made, but we are always shackled in terms of these elements of kinship. And so unwinding that paradox is part of that book, and also looking at this historical background, but also as a basis, a foundation, how do we move forward civically? And you asked about the revolutions. The first is in the Near East, as I described. The second is in the Middle Ages, particularly under Pope Gregory. The seventh, the emergence of the idea of the corporation, not in a strict economic sense, but as an organization based on civic principles, or for Pope Gregory, so religious principles, rather than kinship, begins to emerge. It's a very underappreciated moment in history because it has a dramatic impact on the emergence of guilds, corporations of different kinds, Italian city republics. Later on, it generates this modular model for the Dutch East India Company, later on the nation state itself as this, quote, corporate body. And the third is this unfinished revolution I referred to earlier of the human rights, post-World War II human rights revolution. And so we are unteasing those dynamics in order to, you know, look forward and how we deal with the challenges we have now.
Right.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Very interesting. So, I mean, one of the things about the book that, you know, struck me and I think is a central idea for you in the book is the relevance of this thing called the guild to rejuvenating citizenship today. And since probably most people barely know what a guild really is or was, and, you know, need to be reminded, maybe you could tell us a little bit about, you know, what the guild was. And obviously this is part of Gregory's reforms, but, you know, how is it relevant to us today as a way of rejuvenating our civic lives?
So, yeah, it's, as I was saying, in terms of Pope Gregory, it is this, and he, by the way, an extraordinary pope in a number of changes. He, for example, introduces celibacy in the priesthood, and which we now look as a highly reactionary step. But it was also an attack on kinship and feudalism, actually, because I say this as a footnote. I'll get to the question in a moment, but because he was trying to control, he was trying to claw back the property of bishops and others back to the church. But to do that, he broke this thread of kinship, of inheritance. And in terms of more religious principles, his intentions were more narrow, more broadly in this sanctioning the corporation and his struggle against secular authorities and to support religious orders. But as I said, this is a keyhole moment that has quite dramatic effects. I mentioned some of them, but a lot of it, again, the kind of paradoxes of history play out. It's this corporate idea sets the ground, the seed in part, sets the seed for Protestant dissenters who come later, for example. But crucially, what the guilds did as they, because we don't really see them before the 11th century in Europe, we do see them in China in different forms, for example. But what the guilds do crucially is they merge economic interests in trades and crafts together with mutual aid, shared identity, and a broader political vision in their towns and cities. So they had a critical civic role. The guilds, with an important exception I'll come to in a moment, they were civic groups. They came together on civic principles. They had charters. They had civic goals. They crossed across Europe, particularly Western Europe. They had a political role. They had representatives on the town councils. Citizenship in this medieval, late medieval period was contingent often on membership of the guild. You couldn't become a citizen if you're doing part of the guild, sometimes vice versa. So they were often the civil guard of the towns. They played a critical role in the Italian city republics, and particularly in the famous ones we know, you know, Siena, Florence, Venice. And their core was economic in crafts and trades, but they had a critical role in shaping the politics of the place in which they were in. And so the members of the guild had this, their citizenship was imbued in the guild and shaped not just the guild itself, but beyond the guild. And they were a basis of association with an important exception I'll mention, of kinship, of transcending kinship, and this seed of pivotal long-term institutional developments, and in that sense, also a modular building block for civic societies on multiple scales. Now, the question is, why is this relevant that you were just asking? Why is this relevant now? But before I get to that, there is a big exception to the civic nature of the guilds, which the early writers, not that early, in recent decades, tended to idealize the guilds. And we do have to recognize there was severe discrimination with a handful of exceptions across Europe, particularly against two groups, women and Jews. And at local level, other guilds had their own, prejudices. But within that, there would be a lot of civic engagement. Within those parameters, which of course are serious and severe, there would be these civic engagement. And so why is this relevant now? And so we put forward a guild model adapted for the 21st century in the book as a modular nucleus for more developed civic polity. This is not just a claim for kind of blueprint, kind of blue sky blueprint, because it's a building on empirical developments. They're not inevitably leading to a guild, but show the promise for the grounds of a 21st century guild. One is that the corporate environment is increasingly propitious for guild model, and the individual corporations, and there have been some even in previous decades, that can point the way. And what can be termed a second wave in human rights is increasingly evident in the corporate sector and comes under the rubric of ESG or environmental, social, and corporate governance. We can use different labels, but what we can see, and I did a study with colleagues in Florida, where we looked at about 3,600 US corporations and their adoption of ESG principles using MSCI data, one of the huge index funds. And there's a clear pattern, a little bit kind of parallels what we see with human rights after World War II, that we see something of a inflection point in the mid 10s, 2013, 20 to 2016, a kind of what I've called an on-ramp, just as we see in the 1970s with human rights, where sufficient numbers of corporations are adopting sufficient numbers of ESG precepts to suggest we're seeing a real trend. It's not to say it's inevitable, but we're seeing a real trend. Now, together that, we see an enormous level of laws being passed on local levels, on state levels, on national levels, global compacts, on things like slavery in the supply chain, environmental issues, and a shift in the language, for example, to the idea of the stakeholder as opposed to the stockholder principles. And stakeholders are not only those internal to a corporation, but secondary stakeholders, local communities, those impacted environmentally. And strikingly, in the last couple of years, the U.S. Business Council, the most important business council of corporate America, has adopted this shift in the language to stakeholder from stockholder. There've been other factors like the digitization of the economy has made for much more transparency and the ability to critique corporations. And this ESG, so to speak, movement, it's not a literal movement, but does not promote a guild model as such, but it provides the conditions for which guilds could be structured. There's also another aspect, important background here to understand why this is critical. One is to ask, can this happen, how it may happen? But the other is why it's critical for civic politics. We have to keep in mind that the corporation has become so extraordinarily important in shaping people's lives and the world itself, from the environment to human rights. And yet, as many have observed, the ability of the state to regulate corporations has declined significantly. As one economist put it, corporations, I'm quoting him here, have scale and power that dwarfs the resources available to governments of most countries to regulate the societal impact of corporate activity, end quote. And to give you just one datum point of this, of the 100 largest world economic entities, 69 are corporations rather than countries. The world's top 10 corporations, which includes companies like Walmart, Shell, Apple, have a combined revenue of more than the 180 poorest, so, you know, poorest in quotation marks, countries put together. And these countries include countries such as Ireland, Indonesia, Colombia, Greece, South Africa, Vietnam. And so the 21st Century Guild has a prescriptive model, can pull on empirical developments, can help democratize corporations, but equally important, provide a new pathway to revive citizenship while harnessing the corporate sector for civic goals. By the way, profit remains important. And you see this in the medieval guilds. There's always this understanding to be viable, you have to be profitable. So it's not a return to, say, a socialist model as such, you know, and we've seen versions of this, for example, in Sweden, where you'd have the labor sector, the unions, the corporate sector, and governments negotiating social compacts, but always with the knowledge these companies had to remain competitively internationally. So the guild, the 21st century guild, we believe can provide an alternative pathway to political engagement, confronting the democratic distrust, the deficit, the shoring up the legitimacy of the state. And we can see civic demands on corporations have been growing from stakeholders and the public on issues from climate to punishing Russia for the invasion of Ukraine. There's one other point I'll make about the guild, both historically and thinking prescriptively. They were juridical democracies. The analogy to think about, and by juridical democracies, they had certain judicial goals, civic goals, around which people debated. When we think prescriptively, as an analog, and it's talked about in the book, of the jury. You come together in a jury, 12 jurors, which, by the way, goes back to the Vikings, this idea of 12 jurors, and the judge gives a set of instructions. Here is the civic goal, let's say, criminal justice. Here are the procedures you follow. Yeah, what constitutes fair evidence? Yeah, is what constitutes hearsay, et cetera, et cetera. And then the 12 jurors get together, driven by that goal, and engage on it. So the fact, and we know this doesn't work always, but in the main, it works well, whether you are black or white, rich or poor, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, is left at the door. And you're focused, so it's a way of getting that kind of engagement we are missing in severe ways at this time.
Right. So, I mean, just as an aside, I recently sat through a jury trial, and I have to say it was incredibly encouraging to me. I mean, in about 10 minutes, maybe less actually, we came to the conclusion that, you know, the guy who was charged with the crime in question, you know, might have done it, but there was simply no evidence really pointing to that conclusion. You know, the prosecutor had done a very bad job, or it was a skein of bad jobs that, you know, made it impossible really to prosecute the guy. So you know, he may have, and everybody in the room, I thought, well, I'm going to, you know, say this, but who knows whether people will agree with this. Everybody agreed with it immediately. It was very heartening, I have to say. But in any case, we're running thin on time. So I want to, you mentioned the Vikings, and I mentioned in the introduction that you were doing some work on the Vikings. Maybe you could tell us in 2 to 3 minutes, you know, what that's all about.
Well, the Vikings are fascinating. It's a project that started in a conversation. Jan Bull, who's the curator of the Vikingship Museum in Oslo, an eminent archaeologist, had when I was in Oslo as a Fulbright research fellow. And after about 20 minutes, we decided to start this project. And Jan brought in two additional people, Liz Marianne Strand, an osteologist, and Susie Nagel, who works on runestones. And the fascinating story with the Vikings is there's no written Viking Scandinavia. There's no written records. I'll give the short version of this. So we needed a specific methodology in order to try tell a story about the Vikings. And in our case, Viking violence. And we looked at the way we did it is look at patterns of violence we see cutting across history. We drew on the sociologist Norbert Elias, a number of others. Elias's argument has more recently been reprised by Steven Pinker, and that as authority centralizes, violence goes down. And so what we did, we wanted to see, and by the way, in terms of violence, there are all kinds of fascinating patterns that cut across history that are worth investigation. And what we did in the Viking case, because there are no records, written records, aside from the runestones themselves, which are limited, obviously, in their text, is we looked for indicators of violence. And what we did is Lisa, the osteologist on the team, who studies these Viking skeletons in Norway, we took a sample, representative sample of skeletons to look at the level of skeletal trauma. And then we used other studies in Denmark on skeletal trauma. Secondly, we looked at swords. And the Vikings killed with other weapons like axes, but swords is unambiguously about violence. And at the sheer numbers of swords in both Norway and in the region that is Norway and the region that is Denmark. And for the centralizing state, we looked at the built environment. At some point, the built environment gets so large, walls, fortresses, etc., that the clan system cannot support it. You need a more centralized command and control. And we looked at runestones because runestones have a lot of dedications. You know, I dedicate the stone to my son who died in the Great North War. It was a typical kind of thing. We looked at a lot of different data on the runestones, including about women's status, which was quite fascinating to us. And what we find is that there's an extraordinary level of trauma, of killing in Norway. 40% of people are dying a violent death. In Denmark, it's 4 to 5%. That is high by modern standards, but not the highest. Honduras is about 7% for its male population today. So in swords, Denmark was probably estimated to be, and this in the period 750 to 1050, about you know, a third to a fifth of the population of Norway is a third to a fifth of the population of Denmark. And yet there are thousands of recovered swords in Norway, over 3,000 from the Viking period. In Denmark, it's less than 100 that we've recovered. People in Norway were going around heavily armed. In Denmark, they were usually carrying knives and for utility purposes. 50% of graves in Norway had swords and other weaponry. 1% in Denmark. What was going on? Well, the other indicators that we had a much more centralizing authority over that period, increasingly centralized, And the runestones show us a much more social hierarchy of a society. The Norwegian runestones were all about kin relationships. The Danish, you had lords and ladies, you had thanes, you had various ranks. So I could go at some length, but given the shortage of time, we could tell a story about the violence, and it's also the quality of violence. In the case of the Norwegians, it was mostly on the cranium, on the skull. It was interpersonal. There was various signs of people being having skeletal trauma but surviving, the bone healed, and then others where they died. In Denmark, the trauma is lower, 4 to 5%, but it is all death. Why? Because it's on the neck, it's about beheadings, and it's about hangings. And that again is points to official violence, what today we would call state violence. These were different societies, and that's the one of the findings of this project, because the Viking Scandinavia has been dealt with as sociologically one space. No. And this is reinforced that in recent couple of years of genetic studies, which show that the Norwegian Vikings had a distinct genetic profile, overlapping but distinct from the genetic profile of the Danes.
It's a fascinating agenda, but I'm afraid we're out of time. And I'm just going to have to encourage people to get the Citizenship, the Third Revolution book, and to look at its analysis and the recommendations for how to kind of pull us back towards a citizenship agenda. And I don't know if any of the Viking work is published yet, but I gather it will be coming out soon, and I encourage people to look at that as well.
There's a preprint available.
I see. Out online.
Online, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, great. Well, thanks very much. I want to thank David Jacobson for his insights about the past and future of citizenship and of, I suppose you could say, of the state, or at least the centralization, the monopolization of legitimate means of violence, that very important idea. I want to thank Osvaldo Medina Aguilar for his technical assistance, and I want to thank Duncan McKay for giving us the right to use his song International Horizons for the theme music of the show. Look forward to having you with us for the next episode of International Horizons. Thanks very much.